Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's always fun to talk about the dimensions of DNA. For example, there's enough DNA in a single cell to stretch 6 feet. There's enough DNA in the human body to reach Pluto from the sun. But more interesting by far are the stories about DNA that reveal who we are as artists or musicians, athletes, and more. Joining us now to talk about that is Sam Keen. He's the author of a new book on the topic. It's called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. In his debut bestseller, The Disappearing Spoon, Sam Keen told the histories of the elements of the periodic table and thereby told the stories of the day, its thinkers, and more. His work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Slate, and New Scientist, among others, and he also has been featured on NPR's Radiolab and All Things Considered. Sam Keen, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
A Washington Post reporter in a story about you last month talked about our obsession with who we are and the growing popularity of those genealogy shows. To what extent do you think that obsession is fueled by our growing understanding of genetics? Is this a new phenomenon or something that's been around a long time?
Well, there's obviously been a long-standing interest in genealogy, but what genetics can do is genetics can really reach kind of deeper into the past than you could get through a lot of other sources. You can find things out about your deep history, for instance, the ultimate source of your ancestors, things like that. And it can also help you by filling in gaps as well. So I think what it's really done is it's really added a tool to these kind of to the kind of work they do in genealogy. And it has kind of revived interest in it. I think a lot of people who might not have been interested in, you know, like digging through records and things like that can get interested in it through DNA because it does have kind of a broader appeal.
As part of your research, you sent off a vial of your saliva to be analyzed by a mail order genetic testing company. And you said you did it as a lark, but that it brought out in you maybe the darker side of too much information.
It did, yeah. I sent it off in kind of a frivolous state of mind, just thinking I'd maybe find something funny or unusual about my genes that I could use in kind of illustrating genetics. But when I went to register the test online, I saw that they were going to be testing for certain diseases, which I knew would probably come up. But the thing that really stopped me is when I saw that they would be testing for Parkinson's disease. And that stopped me because my grandfather died of Parkinson's, and I had a lot of memories from the time. I was a little too young to understand what was going on, but I did have a strong emotional reaction to seeing the chances that I might find out something about myself and my susceptibility to Parkinson's. And I ended up sort of blacking that information out. You can basically redact certain information that you don't want to see because I just didn't think I could face it. In the course of writing the book, however, I feel like I got an education in how genes work and what it really does mean to be susceptible to a disease. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that I didn't have to be afraid of what I might find in my DNA. And by the end of writing the book, I actually went in and broke the electronic seal and took a look at what was in my genes. And I'm very glad that I did so.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sam Keen. He's an author and science writer. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. If you have a question or comment for Sam, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, post your question or comment there, or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. Was there anything in that vial that surprised you, that you were kind of bracing yourself for the Parkinson's issue, but was there something you hadn't been bracing yourself for that surprised you?
A lot of the things are things that you kind of know about yourself. For instance, I found out I didn't metabolize caffeine very well, and, you know, I've had coffee or a Coke late at night that left me jittery. But there were susceptibility to other things I really hadn't thought about because they didn't come up in my family, things like prostate cancer and things like that. So it was a mix of things that you kind of knew about yourself, but it was interesting to see them confirmed genetically. And then other things that I hadn't quite anticipated. I did look at my ancestry a little bit too, and found out a little bit about the ultimate source of the Y chromosome that I have. You know, I knew I had generally a European background, but found out it was actually a little more to the east than I thought. It kind of came out of the Caucasus area in Eastern Europe. And so, yeah, there were it was, again, a mix of things that you know about yourself, but also things you never quite anticipated either.
How do you go about, well, I guess I was wondering how you decided to do this in the first place. It seems to be similar to the approach you took with the disappearing spoon. It's sort of the stories behind the story.
Yeah, what I really wanted to emphasize throughout the book was stories. Everything from stories about our very earliest hours as a species, you know, 100,000 years ago, all the way up to the glories of modern civilization and retro-diagnosing your favorite historical celebrity, things like that. And I guess what really convinced me to write the book was in seeing all the ways that genetics was popping up in fields that I really didn't expect it to. I think when people think of genetics, they immediately think of medicine. And of course, it's a very important part of genetics. But genetics has really contributed to a lot more fields than just medicine. You can find genetics in doing archaeology work. You can find it in history. You can find it in all the other areas of biology that don't necessarily have anything to do with medicine. And there were just so many really great stories out there about the human past that I thought I could really get together a really nice book. It's kind of a collection of these stories. One good example of this, and this is an example that doesn't even necessarily involve human DNA. If you look at the lice, the human lice, there is lice on our hair, and there's body lice that can only live inside clothing. And human beings have had this long ago in hunter-gatherer populations. It's very, very common. But of course, for a while, we weren't wearing clothes. And it's only when we started wearing clothes that body lice really could get a footing. They're related to head lice, but they are a distinct species. And so what scientists were able to do is look at the DNA of body lice and look at the DNA of head lice and kind of trace them backwards. You can use DNA sort of like a clock in that way. And they found out when the two species started to diverge. And from that information, they could tell when we really started wearing clothing for the first time. And so that's just an example of the really fascinating things, the stories you can find out about human beings, stories that we probably thought were lost, that we'd never be able to find much information about, because things like clothing really aren't preserved in the fossil record. But through DNA, we're able to read a lot of these stories for the very first time. And it's really an exciting feeling to kind of look at the past in this way.
You wrote at the start of the book that to understand what DNA and genes really are, we have to decouple the two words, and that how scientists yoked them together in the first place was the first, as you call it, epic story in the science of inheritance.
Yeah, when you think about genes and DNA, they're obviously very closely related to each other, but they are distinct things. DNA is, it's a chemical, it's a thing. You can get it stuck to your fingers. Genes also have a physical basis, of course, but they're better thought of as a little more abstract. The way I like to think of it is that genes are like a story, and DNA is like the language that story is written in. And what genes do is they tell stories about you know, why you have blonde hair or why you have green eyes or why you have hitchhiker's thumb, things like that. And so you can talk about genes, about inheritance, without really understanding that DNA has anything to do with it. And in fact, for a very long time, scientists did talk about genes and studied them without realizing DNA had anything to do with it. They thought that genes were controlled by other substances inside cells. And it's kind of an interesting, unusual story. I think a lot of people know about Gregor Mendel. He was the monk who studied pea plants, and he was the one who really discovered that genes existed. He kind of highlighted them for the first time. And it wasn't until 30 years or so after he did that work, and long after he died, that people recognized what important work he'd done. But really, the exact same thing, a very parallel situation, happened with DNA. A young scientist named Friedrich Miescher discovered DNA in the 1860s, wrote up a paper about it, and got credit for discovering it. But really, no one paid any attention to what he'd done. They thought inheritance was controlled by other chemicals, and even though he kind of struggled to promote DNA as an important substance, no one really paid attention. And it wasn't until long after he died that he got credit for making this really fundamental discovery. And so there's kind of, again, a parallel story there between the lives of Mendel and Miescher, two men who died kind of obscure and unknown, and no one really gave them the credit that they deserve. So the first chapter of the book is really dedicated to bringing out that story, those parallels, and then to getting into explaining how scientists first decided and realized that DNA was the basis of genes and kind of controlled our inheritance.
But first, there was the rivalry between Mendelism and Darwinism. And I was wondering, why did they do? But you had a funny line in there about why can't you just see it, stupid? You know, kind of like a line from Wheel of Fortune, I think you put it. So you wrote about that rivalry. I was wondering, why did they do battle in the first place, and how did an American wind up being the guy who settled the argument?
Yeah, it's kind of forgotten today. I don't think most people realize it, but for a long time, or right around 1900, scientists really didn't think much of Darwin. They were actually, most scientists, in fact, were against Darwin. It's not that they didn't believe in evolution. They believed evolution happened. What they didn't believe in was that Darwin had figured out the proper mechanism for evolution. They didn't think natural selection made much sense, because they thought that evolution must happen much more slowly than, or excuse me, they thought evolution happened much more quickly than Darwin ever thought. Darwin always emphasized that evolution was very slow and plodding. But they wanted to think about evolution as happening kind of quickly, moving very fast. And Mendel's theories, Mendelism, seemed to offer a way to speed evolution up. When Mendel was working with pea plants, he would see either tall or short stalks, or he would see green or yellow peas. There seemed to be kind of a jumpiness, a discreteness that you don't get with Darwin. And so a lot of people thought that Mendel had a better theory that really explained more about biology, and they were kind of willing to consign Darwin to the dust heap of history. And, you know, it is kind of hard for us to understand today. And as you mentioned, it's kind of like if you're watching Wheel of Fortune and you see almost all the letters there and you know what it is, but the person on the TV just can't figure the phrase out. And you're yelling at the TV saying, just think, it's all right there. But people just couldn't quite see how Darwinism and Mendelism meshed. And it took the work of another person to really get into that and explain that for the first time.
My guest is Sam Keen. He is author and science writer. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. Welcome your questions or comments. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to watch Columbus on the Record tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, news director Mike Thompson and his panel provide an in-depth analysis of several topics, including Governor Kasich's education overhaul plan and budget surpluses at the State House and Columbus City Hall. Watch Columbus on the Record. It's tonight at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. And it's 8 degrees in downtown Columbus. With the wind chill, it feels like negative 11. Sunshine today with a high of 13. Increasing clouds tonight with a chance of some light snow and a low of 9 degrees. Snow is expected for Saturday with 1 to 3 inches of accumulation possible, a high of 25. A little bit of snow is likely also Saturday night, a low of 23. And some light snow again expected on Sunday with a high of 29. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Sam Keane. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code. Questions or comments for Sam Keane, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Tom in Marion, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning. I would think there's a major downside to knowing the possibility, or maybe even the probability, of a disease for which there is no cure. Take, for example, Alzheimer's. Such as Alzheimer's. If your genetic code showed that you had a high possibility or probability of having Alzheimer's, different people could handle that in different ways, I think. Do you agree?
Yeah, I definitely think there are different ways to approach it. And some people, quite understandably, just don't want to know. They don't want to face it. They probably have memories of a family member suffering from it or something like that. And they just don't want to have that hanging over their head, that knowledge. But there other people look at it in a different way. There are certainly things that you can do, maybe not necessarily for Alzheimer's, but for other diseases, to lower your risk for it, or at least you can start preparing for it. So some people find the knowledge beneficial in that they can do things like change their diet or start exercising or at least be prepared for it. So, you know, I can kind of look at it both ways, because I did in writing the book feel both ways. At first, I didn't want to know. I didn't want to have that knowledge. But once I really, started looking more into it, I decided that it would be better for me at least to look into something like that.
At least you had a choice individually of whether you wanted to know those certain things or not. So I agree with your answer on that.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, we have another question about the test. So, Sam Keane. David in Columbus, you're on the air with Sam Keane. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, Ann. I really enjoyed the show. I listen to it every day.
Thank you.
I was wondering, when you get this kind of test done, how do you go about getting the test, what the costs are, where would you have something like this done? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Well, there are a few services around that can do this kind of work. You can find them online. And basically what happens is they send you a plastic vial in the mail. You fill it with saliva. You send it back. And they process it for you. They kind of do all the work for you. You just have to end up paying for it and providing them the sample. And after that, they really kind of lay out everything that they found. They kind of explain your risk or your susceptibility to certain diseases, whether it's higher than normal compared to other people in the population and things like that. So once you really find the service, they usually take care of most of the rest of it for you. And you do have to be careful with this kind of work, because they're not going to I mean, genes really don't deal in certainties. They deal in probabilities. And a lot of this work is preliminary. Scientists are always finding out new things. So what they tell you might not necessarily reflect reality just because we don't know exactly what's going on yet.
I read that you were surprised by how many other topics intersected with DNA, including a story about a double atomic bomb survivor, whose story, I think that's the story you kick off chapter three with.
Yeah, this was a man named Tsutomu Yamaguchi. He was in Japan, in Hiroshima specifically, on August 6, 1945. And so he was, of course, exposed to the nuclear bomb that went off there. He had kind of a horrendous few days. He was pretty close to it. His arm got burned. He was suffering from radiation poisoning, very acute case of it. And he ended up getting on a train, finally, to get him out of Hiroshima a couple days later. Unfortunately for him, his hometown happened to be Nagasaki, and he ended up showing up there not long before this second atomic bomb went off. So he was one of the very few people who saw both atomic bombs go off. And he suffered from radiation poisoning again, the second round, after Nagasaki. But what was really amazing about the whole story is that despite suffering from this acute radiation poisoning, he actually lived until 2010. He lived 65 extra years after being exposed to both atomic bombs. And what radiation really does is it affects your DNA. It causes mutations inside your DNA in various ways. But your body has ways to fight back against these mutations. It has ways to repair DNA, especially. And we can infer from that Yamaguchi had a very good DNA repair system inside his body. So I use this story, this incredible story of someone being exposed to both atomic bombs, to kind of explain how DNA repair works and what mutations can do inside your body and how they can cause harm in the first place.
How did you end up coming up with the title for the book, The Violinist's Thumb? Tell us that story.
Yeah, I picked the title because I really thought it was a good sort of representative of the kind of stories that were inside the book. The story has to do with a violinist named Niccolo Paganini. He's usually considered the greatest violinist who ever lived. He was active in Europe in the early 1800s. He was playing for popes and for Napoleon and for other kings around. And there were always rumors that he had sold his soul to Satan for his talent. That's how good a violinist he was. And part of the reason he was so good in reality, aside from the question of whether he sold his soul or not, was that he had these kind of amazingly, freakishly flexible fingers. He could twist them into all sorts of different positions and poses. He could spread his hands incredibly wide compared to normal people. And he could just do things with his hands that lesser violinists simply could not. And from a modern perspective, it's almost certain that Paganini had some sort of genetic disorder, and that's what gave him these really incredible hands. And I like the story because, it shows some themes in the book. Paganini had these incredible hands, but he was also a very, very hard worker, and he was also very, very passionate about music. He loved playing, and he loved practicing. So it was kind of this perfect storm of a trait like the hands, the genetic endowment, coming together with a temperament that could really take advantage of the genetic endowment. So it really is a good example of how your genes and your environment work together to make you who you are. And I think that's the case even today. You look at, Michael Phelps in the Olympics. He had a body that was perfectly made for swimming with his enormous feet, his tiny waist, things like that. But he also had to work very hard, very long, to become the great swimmer he was. And even for normal, everyday people, it's really your genes and your environment working together to make you who you are. The other reason I did pick the story as the title story, though, was because even though his genes helped make him in one sense, Paganini's genes also end up unmaking him in another sense. The same genetic disorder that gave him very flexible hands also led to a lot of other health problems. And by the end of his life, Paganini wasn't able to play music in public at all. And he, in fact, died pretty young from this ailment and from some other things that he picked up trying to get treated for this ailment, some very harsh medicines, things like that. So I think it does go to show that genes are often double-edged like that. They can give you an advantage in one sense, but they can be a disadvantage at the same time in another sense. So that's why I chose the violinist thumb.
If you're just joining us, it's All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest is Sam Keen. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius as Written by Our Genetic Code. How did you come across that story? How did you find these kinds of stories? Are these things that geneticists study?
If you're talking about retro-diagnosing historical celebrities,
yes,
that is something that a lot of people really get excited about. If you look through the medical literature, you can find all sorts of guesses about how Emperor so-and-so died of this and Pharaoh so-and-so died of this. And unfortunately, you can kind of get unmoored from reality pretty quickly. There's a part in the book where I list all of these supposed things that Charles Darwin suffered from. And it's everything from, you know, an adrenal gland tumor and lupus all the way up to pigeon allergies and lactose intolerance. There's just sort of endless speculation about this. And genetics in some ways can kind of add a measure of objectivity to it. If you can get the material to test the person, you can sometimes answer a question about whether they had this disease or a different disease. The problem, though, is you can't always get access to the material. There have been people who wanted to test Abraham Lincoln, for instance, people who wanted to test Chopin, the composer. But there have been questions about whether or not that's appropriate, because you have to destroy small bits of whatever artifact you're using, whether it's a bone or, in Chopin's case, I believe they have his heart somewhere in a church or something, and you would have to end up destroying a small bit of that. So unless you have a pretty good idea of exactly what you're looking for and exactly what mutation causes it, genetics might not provide the clear answer that you're hoping for.
So I have another call about that test. Patrick in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I got a question about privacy. How private are the results? Say, for instance, you don't want your employer to find out, you know, or insurance companies, you know, stuff
okay.
like that, but find out if, you know, you're going to develop Alzheimer's or something, for instance.
Okay. Sam Keen?
Yeah, the tests are private. It's just like other online accounts that you have. You have a username, you have a password, and unless you share that information with an employer or with an insurance company, they would really have no way of knowing that you maybe have a susceptibility to something. And even if they did know you had a susceptibility, there's, of course, no guarantee that you would come down with the disease in the future. I do know that some of the companies use that information in doing research on genetic traits. They might have you fill out a survey that asks you whether you have certain symptoms or things like that, and then they could use your DNA to, along with a lot of other people's DNA, to try to figure out what maybe causes that condition or symptom. But as far as I know, they kind of scrub personal information out of that. So the scientists aren't seeing, well, this person, your specific name, has this DNA. They're just seeing that people, you know, like 50 people without names attached to them have this trait and also have this DNA. So there are definitely privacy issues out there about this, but I don't think that an insurer, for instance, would have ready access to this information.
Thanks, Patrick, for the call. Thanks. Appreciate it. An email from Pav writes, if viruses change your DNA, are those changes passed on to you from your ancestors?
That's actually one of the startling and really interesting things I found out inside the book. If you look at the DNA inside you that makes proteins, the things we normally think about traditionally as our genetic inheritance, that only makes up about 2% of your DNA total. But at the same time, 8% of your DNA is actually old, broken down virus DNA that just gets passed from generation to generation. So by that measure, at least, we're four times more virus than we are human. And it's kind of scary to think about. What actually happens is these viruses, HIV is probably the best known example. These viruses go inside you, and they want to make more copies of themselves. That's what viruses are programmed to do. But instead of kind of taking the responsibility to make copies of themselves, what they do is they take their genetic material and they paste it inside your own DNA. And that kind of tricks your cells into making more copies of the viruses without the viruses really having to do anything. It's really an insidious but admittedly sort of clever way for viruses to trick your cells into doing this. And based on the fact that 8% of our DNA is old, broken down virus DNA, we know that this happens actually kind of more than we'd probably like to think about. And whether it actually gets passed on to the next generation depends. If a virus gets inside you and changes your DNA, that really doesn't matter to your children unless the virus changes DNA inside a sperm or an egg cell, because that's the only DNA that really gets passed on to your offspring. So it does have to affect DNA in a certain specific area of your body. And I think one of the really fascinating things about the viruses doing this to our DNA, a lot of it, as I said, is just old, broken-down DNA. It doesn't do much. But there are some exceptions to this. There is virus DNA inside us that does do something. The best known, probably the most important example of this, is inside the human placenta, because placentas have to go in from the inside the mother's womb. They have to go into the uterus, and they have to fuse to the uterus wall to kind of anchor themselves there. And the protein that they use to start this fusion process has actually been stolen from a virus, because that's one of the talents of viruses. They can fuse to cells and kind of make themselves one with the cell. It's very similar to what the placenta does. And it's kind of scary to think about that the ultimate origin of the mammal placenta comes from a virus, but we stole the gene for our own end, and now it's part of us today.
Wow. My guest is Sam Keen. He's an author and science writer. We're talking about his latest book. It's called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code. If you have a question or comment for Sam, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Go to our Facebook page or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Super Bowl festivities in New Orleans got off to a rough start when Ravens star linebacker Ray Lewis was accused of using deer antler spray to improve his performance. Lewis angrily denied it, pawed the ground, and then impaled Bob Costas on his horns. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the news quiz that obviously is not performance enhanced. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me tomorrow morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to stay with us in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. All Sides Weekend begins with host Marilyn Smith and a conversation about the best food and restaurants in Central Ohio. Stay with us for All Sides Weekend from 11 till noon. And support for 89.7 NPR News at the $85 level gets you a great benefit. It's the WOSU Member Card. The Member Card is good for dining and admission discounts at more than 200 Member Card partners in Central Ohio. Visit WOSU.org/membercard for more information and make that gift of $85 or more. Thank you for your support of 89.7 NPR News. 8 degrees with some sunshine, a high near 13 today, but with a wind chill making it feel like negative 11. Clouds tonight with a chance of some light snow, a low of 9 degrees. Expect about 1 to 3 inches of snow on Saturday and a high of 25. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Sam Keen. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Peter and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Sam, I'm reading your book right now, and I think you really need to explain to the audience ZIPF's law that you have in there. I found that fantastic. please start off with the story about the counting the number of words, and then as it relates to paintings and music, and then finally our DNA. And I'll take my question offline, but it was fantastic, Sam. Good book. Thank you.
Okay, thank
Thanks,
you.
Peter. That's ZIP, Z as in zebra, IPF?
Yes, that is. Yep, that's ZIP's law. And it's a law that has to do with linguistics. If you look at the number of words in a language, the most common word in English, it's the, appears twice as often as the second most common word, which is and, three times as often as the third most common word, 100 times as often as the 100th most common word, and so on. It's kind of this eerie empirical relationship between how often words appear and their popularity related to the most common word in a language. And the story he was talking about counting words has to do with the man who came up with the law named George Kingsley Zipf. A friend once described Zipf as someone who would take a rose apart petal by petal in order to count the number of petals on it. He was just that kind of person who liked to dissect things, take them apart. And he started off his career by studying James Joyce's book, Ulysses. But the important thing he got out of it was he counted the number of words in it, and he ended up counting the number of times that different words appeared in it. So he really kind of missed the forest for the trees there, really looking at focusing on how many words were in it and things like that. And it wasn't just with Ulysses. He did it with a lot of other books. And it ties back to DNA because there is a lot of linguistic features about DNA, about how often certain stretches of DNA appear and other features that really show that DNA does function like a language. It has suffixes and prefixes and punctuation, all these sorts of things that we associate with DNA, we associate with languages pop up in DNA as well. And in fact, it's kind of hard to even talk about or discuss DNA without going into the study of languages. So there's a really strong parallel between the two that I explain in full in the book.
You said your favorite are DNA palindromes?
Yes. phrases like madam, I'm Adam, or sex at noon taxes. They are phrases that read the same forward and backward, and these aren't just in DNA. Inside DNA, it's not just like they're funny and you see one and you're like, oh, that's kind of amazing. They really play an important role in especially the Y chromosome. The Y chromosome is kind of It's kind of a hard luck evolutionary story for various reasons. It can't do things that other chromosomes inside you can do. For instance, it has a really hard time correcting mistakes inside it. But because of the palindromes inside it, it does have an easier time correcting these mistakes for various reasons. So palindromes, in fact, kind of saved the Y chromosome from destruction, many scientists think.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. He had mentioned radiation, that it affects DNA, and I'm wondering if the radiation from, you know, towers, cell towers, television towers, radiation that might be coming off laptop, microwave, is that affecting our DNA? Because I just think there's a whole lot more cancer than there used to be.
Well, when you're talking about radiation, you're really just talking about light. Light is simply radiation. It's just another word for it. So when you're talking about cancer, you have to be very specific about what type of radiation you are talking about. And maybe I wasn't as precise as I should have been. When you're talking about an atomic bomb, you're talking about things like gamma rays, very high-powered radiation. Things like your microwave could potentially, if you are exposed to it, do damage to your DNA. But microwaves are, of course, they contain it. They're fairly safe unless you have something like a pacemaker inside you. So I really have not seen any studies that really show a strong incidence of cancer among people who, say, live next to towers or from cell phones, things like that. So I really haven't seen anything like that for most of the forms of radiation that people are exposed to day to day.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Sam Keen, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You made an interesting point in an interview with Popular Science. It was well over a year ago. It's when you were just starting to work on this book. You said that we're no smarter than the ancient Greeks or Egyptians or Chinese in the arts, but we know immeasurably more science. And I was wondering, do you wonder whether we're ready, whether our brains are ready to know the science, whether our society is ready, whether our brains are big enough, or perhaps enough of our brains are big enough?
I think everyone who thinks about these kind of things does have that sort of worry that maybe we are getting knowledge that we're perhaps not ready for. But on the other hand, I don't know if we'll ever necessarily be ready for that type of knowledge. It's not like we're suddenly going to get smarter 100 years from now and then suddenly be able to handle it. Right. We're probably going to be basically the same people then as we are now. So I don't know that there's ever really a good time for it, other than we just have to prepare ourselves and hope that we're wise enough to use scientific advances in the way that we should.
I guess I used that question to preface talk about the Human Genome Project, as you call it, saga. And I think it was in an interview you said, in all its nobility and all its hilarious pettiness, you know, this is some pretty important stuff. Can you talk about Craig Venter, why he was, where he was in terms of the Human Genome Project, how it came about, and why it isn't some big government program versus what it ended up being?
Yeah, I feel like I have to be a little cautious speaking about this because there are a lot of scientists out there today who are still very mad at Ventnor,
right,
very bitter about the whole thing. And you know, I've gotten an earful from a lot of them about even bringing up Ventnor. They don't even want to talk about him. What basically happened was the government, a consortium of government groups and various universities, decided they wanted to sequence, read the entire human genome. A few years into the process, Craig Ventnor jumped in with a plan that he said could sequence the entire genome for about a tenth of the cost and in just a few years, whereas the government project was taking, you know, 15, 16, 17 years, something like that. And part of the problem wasn't just that Ventnor jumped in with this plan. It's really Ventnor's personality that just rubs a lot of people the wrong way. He does like to promote himself, promote his own work. He is a very smart man, and he knows it. And he just, some of the things he did, and especially the fact that he was doing it from the private sector, in a group that could potentially profit off the human genome, really worried a lot of scientists. And it really is an incredible story, just top to bottom. All of the antics that went on behind the scenes, a lot of the vitriol among the scientists. But from that, despite all of the energy they wasted fighting each other, this really amazing thing came out. We can now read the history of our species in our genome for the very first time. So I just think it's a wonderful story, both for the human foibles in it and the incredible human history that came out of it.
Once again, we just have a few minutes left with Sam Keen, author and science writer. We're talking about his book, The Violinist's Thumb, and Other Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code. You say that our evolution could have gone in many different directions. What was the next closest direction? Do we know that? Where do we make the left turn?
That's kind of a hard question because we really can't replay history. I mean, maybe it's inevitable that once human beings split off, our brain evolution especially kind of accelerated and we became very smart. On the other hand, it's quite possible humans could have gone extinct at various points in our history. And in fact, if you look at our DNA, you can find pretty good evidence that our population numbers were alarmingly low for a very long time, as recently as 75 or 80,000 years ago. By some estimates, there were only a few thousand human adults around, which, you know, is less than you might have in a minor league baseball game. And it's really kind of scary to think about there being that few human beings on the entire Earth. We were sort of the endangered species of today, with far fewer numbers than maybe gorillas or chimpanzees have, and we easily could have been wiped out. So I think it's probably fair to say that things could have gone different or even gone horribly wrong for human evolution at various points. And we are pretty lucky that we did pull through and expanded across the globe the way we did.
I saw a T-shirt recently. It said something like, humans share 25% of our DNA with a banana, so get over yourself. And you talk about that.
Yeah, it's really incredible. If you look at all forms of life out there, there's kind of a core number of genes that all life forms share. Usually really basic things about cellular function, cellular processes, things like that. But yeah, it's just really incredible to think about we have all this DNA in common with so many other creatures out there. Depending on how you measure it, we have between like 96 and 99% of our DNA in common with chimpanzees. Mm-hmm. And scientists have recently found out that we actually have, a lot of us have, Neanderthal DNA inside us. So these creatures that a lot of people used to think about as dumb brutes, these Neanderthals, no wonder they went extinct, we actually have their DNA inside us. And we, so in some sense, Neanderthals didn't quite go extinct. They're still out there, at least their DNA is, living inside people. And I really think that beyond all of the things you hear about genetics, improving medicine, things for our physical bodies, one of the important things that genetics will bring about is kind of a mental enrichment, a bigger sense of who we human beings are and where we came from, how we fit in with other life on Earth. And that's one of the things I really emphasized in the book, is that we are connected with other creatures and that our DNA really does help us see this.
So going forward, what of our genetics? How does it doesn't change quickly necessarily, but that can change quickly. What do you see going forward after all this research and putting this book together with all these great stories?
Well, it would be hard to predict what exactly will happen in sort of a natural sense, because mm-hmm. you can't see things like plagues breaking out or whether climate change will require new genes, something like that. You can say, though, that human beings are constantly tinkering with DNA and that we will probably be able to sort of consciously manipulate our DNA in the future. Some scientists are already working on using viruses, for instance, to cure diseases. I mentioned before in the show that viruses have the ability to insert their own genetic material inside us. Well, we can kind of turn that to our own ends by putting in beneficial genes. And if someone has, you know, cystic fibrosis or another genetic disease, it's possible you could use a virus to go in and insert that DNA inside the person's cells and kind of cure them of this disease. As I said, scientists are already working on bringing these therapies to the clinic. But at the same time, you know, it worries a lot of people that we'll be able to make designer babies or things like that. I think people get really frightened of that idea. I don't know if we'll ever be able to get to that point, at least not in the near future, because I think genes are a lot harder than a lot of people realized, harder to understand how they work when the Human Genome Project started. A lot of genes work with each other or work in tandem, or you need a certain environment to turn the genes on or off. So there's a lot of other factors out there that we have to understand about the basic way that genes work before we'll ever really be able to do something like consciously manipulate them.
So, Sam Keen, you've written about the periodic table. You've written about genetics now. Anything coming up next?
My editor and I are working on some ideas. We uh-huh. haven't quite settled on a topic yet. So
okay.
There should be something coming up. And if people actually want to check my website, hopefully I'll be able to put an update up there soon, or
okay.
they can read an excerpt of Violinist Thumb there as well.
All right. Well, we'll post a link to your website. And thanks so much, Sam Keen, for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sam Keen, author and science writer. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Violinist's Thumb and Other Lost Tales of Love, War, and Genius, as written by our genetic code. Thanks very much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.